Well, hey there. This is Endeavors. Hey, and welcome to episode 3 of Endeavors 2.0. On today's show, you will hear author Simon Choa Johnston talk about his book, The House of Wives. It's a very interesting look into, I guess, you know, what it means, just your heritage, examining the heritage, what it means to be, in Simon's case, Chinese Canadian. So it's a fascinating look at that. You'll also hear from writer Jillian Christmas. She's the executive director of the Verses Festival here in Vancouver, as well as music from Jadea Kelly. That's all coming up on today's show. My first guest has worked as a playwright, director, and artistic director, and graduated from McMaster University in 1972. He was born and raised in Hong Kong, and his plays have been seen all over, including the Arts Club Theatre, Gateway Theatre, Western Canada Theatre, the Belfry Theatre, Kaleidoscope Theatre, Youth Theatre Montreal, Collective Arts Production, and the Lighthouse Festival. He was writer-in-residence at the Stratford Shakespeare Festival and was featured at Toronto's Factory Theatre Cross Currents Festival. He is the Artistic Director Emeritus of the Gateway Theatre in Richmond, where he was Artistic and Executive Director from 2000 to 2012. Among his awards are the City of Richmond's Cultural Leadership in 2011, McMaster University Alumni Award winner, TheatreBC's National Playwriting Competition, Canada's 125 Medal for the Arts and Tourism, and 3 Vancouver Jesse nominations for Best Play. He's come out with a novel, The House of Wives, which explores his heritage as a Chinese-Canadian man. He is Simon Choa Johnston, and I spoke to him earlier this summer. So your novel is the House of Wives, and I know it's inspired a lot about the stories of your ancestors. How much of your sort of family history did you know going into the writing of this book?
I knew nothing. That's what really prompted the book. In my day, I'm in my 60s now. In my day, when I was young, asking questions of mixed race parents about their background was something you didn't do. But I was brave enough to try, and I think it was around age 8 or age 10 when my mother finally wanted to shut me up and looked at me very sternly and said, "Your great grandfather was Emmanuel Belilius, a Jewish opium merchant from Calcutta." And the way she looked at me told me never ask that question again. And so I didn't. For decades, I knew nothing other than my parents and perhaps a little bit about my grandparents. But then when the internet was available, I, of course, dived into it, and I found all sorts of information that are part of the public record. And that's really what set me off to writing a novel about that time and about that person. So it was a way of finding out who my genealogy is, where I came from, and a little bit about who I am and what I've inherited.
There's so much history involved, apparent in that part of the world. Just outside of your own family, how much did you learn about sort of the countries that you come from?
Well, I visited India a number of times, and also traced the migration of my Jewish ancestors all the way from Spain through to Venice, and I visited both countries. And then they went to Iraq and settled in Basra. And of course, I couldn't go to Iraq, but picked up the trail again when they were in Bombay and then through to Delhi and then eventually to Kolkata. So that's the eastern or western side of the family history. And I was able to find their names in public records. I was able to find what they did and when they were, when people were born, when they died, the children that they had, and some of the social context in which they lived. And then I traced his movements from Kolkata to Hong Kong. And of course, in Hong Kong, there's all sorts of rich material in the archives and museums. He became the chairman of the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, for example, and he was also a great philanthropist that left a lot of legacies of education, healthcare, and orphanages, as well as the synagogue that still exist in Hong Kong today. So I was able to, over a period of about 10 years, actually trace his footsteps from one side of the world to another.
Given your long background in theater, I'm curious as to why this became a novel rather than a piece for the stage.
Well, it's curiously enough, it started as a play. I was invited to be a playwright in residence at the Stratford Festival in Ontario around 2010, and I had by that time gathered about 10 years worth of material. And I began writing a play about Emmanuel Belilius, the subject of this book. And when I started writing the play, it occurred to me that there was so much material that I needed a larger canvas. I needed a way of bringing about all sorts of other flavors into it that you could not do on a smaller canvas of the stage or the theater, or at least I didn't have the capacity to do it. So looking for a wider canvas gave me the opportunity to start thinking about it as a novel rather than just a play.
Is there a different approach for you when you're writing a novel versus when you're writing something for the stage?
Yes, absolutely. The rudiments are the same. You're trying to tell a story of an interesting and compelling character that is faced with many obstacles, and how he overcomes those obstacles and how he changes at the end is really the traffic of what plays are about. And that's the spine of how you set about in writing a play, or that's how I set about writing a play. In a novel, it's essentially the same thing, except that you can get deeper into a person's thinking inside, you can get inside their head, and you can have a window inside their heart as to what they were feeling and why they were feeling that. But most importantly, you can go behind closed doors and listen in to conversations that might not be available when you're writing a play. So there are some subtle differences, and of course you can broaden the perspective by bringing so many other elements into it, not only the sense of place and the description of the place and how the place influenced the character, but also other characters that might not appear in a small play.
You know, when you were mentioning your ancestors' journey there, especially in Calcutta and Hong Kong, it struck me that, you know, a lot of it, like so many other places in the world, has to do with, you know, colonialism and conquest. I'm wondering if that part of history played into your writing at all, and how maybe you look at that differently now, if you do.
That's a really terrific question that I haven't been able to completely answer for myself. I grew up in Hong Kong. I was born there, and I grew up until after high school, and then came to Canada to go to university, and have stayed in Canada ever since. And when I was growing up in the 60s, you know, Hong Kong was a very, very clearly and precisely a British colony, and with all the good things and the bad things that are involved in colonial upbringing, I had a great education, and it was a safe place to be. But it was very English. There was no real tolerance for heritage things. For example, there was no Hong Kong Museum. There was no access to Hong Kong archives. There was no talk of what a Hong Kong culture might be or a Chinese culture might be. I suspect the same things probably happened in India. And so when everything opened up, particularly at the turn of the millennium in the 2000s, and we were able to access all of this information, it came as a flood of, a thrilling flood of surprises and access to things. So I'm still in the celebration stage of what I have been able to find out from documents that have been released, rather than dwelling on you know, any repression that might have happened during that period of time. It happened. There's nothing I can do about it. What I can do is concentrate on an interesting story about my ancestors trying to make it in the real world.
On a sort of a related question, what do you make of the enhanced conversation that we as a society are having about, you know, colonialism these days?
I really leave that to the political and historical experts. I can only contribute to the conversation by giving a personal account of my family's lives during that period of time and how they might have contributed to the society that exists today. I know that when Emmanuel Belilius, the subject of my book, arrived in Hong Kong from Calcutta, he was a young man of about 25, and he was in a hurry to make it in the world, and in a hurry to make it as a businessman and as a trader. So that's probably what interests me. And what he did and how he did it laid the foundation for what Hong Kong and Calcutta are today, from a business perspective and from a society perspective. So that's my contribution to the conversation. I don't feel I'm really qualified to talk about the politics of looking or examining the politics of that period or the historical exigencies that happen that can influence today. So all I can do is I can contribute to the conversation through the bringing of anecdotal evidence about what it might have been like to live in those days.
Everyone, when people are studying their family history, everyone wants to find something exciting or someone exciting. What was the most maybe interesting thing you discovered about your ancestors, whether it was an Emmanuel or somebody else?
Well, I mean, just the opening line that my mother gave me, which really set me on my quest. Here I was living in Hong Kong, a Eurasian boy going to school, and suddenly, and a Christian, suddenly discovering, of course, that my ancestors were Jewish. Secondly, they were from India, from Calcutta, and thirdly, that he was the foremost opium trader of his time. I mean, those are three things that just knocked me out cold and took me decades to recover from realizing what that was. So those three elements alone were enough to propel me to find out more. And then the fact that he had two wives, one was a Jewish woman in Calcutta and the other one was a Chinese woman whom I'm descended from. So finding the trail of those people was probably the most surprising element of my journey.
Given the subject of this story and you know your work for history, I'm curious as to whether you thought at all about making this a documentary or some sort of non-fiction story.
Yeah, I'm working on a presentation right now that documents sort of the making of or the behind the scenes as to how I found things out, and loaded with photographs and short videos of some of the things that I discovered in the different parts of the world. So that background I'm working on now and will be used as a presentation tool on speaking engagements, which I have lined up all the way through to the fall in different genealogical societies, some universities and some private functions.
You know, I think in this country, there's a lot of, I'm seeing more and more literature about other cultures. You know, whether it's Chinese, Canadian, or whether it's, you know, other forms of other forms of identity and culture. How important is it, do you think, for children who are perhaps not of that background to be exposed to this type of culture?
I think that's a wonderful, wonderful question. And that was probably the most important private motivation for writing this. I wanted my nephews and nieces and to know something about my life and their family. It is very much a responsibility of mine to be able to hand over to the next generation some clues as to where they came from and therefore who they are today, and for them to have a full disclosure of the things that might have happened during that period of time, and for them to come to their own conclusions about who they are and where they fit in the world. So I think it's an extremely important aspect. It's a link between who they are today and where they came from, so that it points a way to who they might become in the future. So I think it's very, very important, and that's one of the motivations for my writing this.
Well, the book is House of Wives. It is out now. Simon Choa Johnston, thanks so much for your time today.
It was an entirely my pleasure.
All right. Have a good one. Cheers.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Simon Choa Johnston. And now here's a song from Jada Kelly off Love and Lust. This is Make It Easy.
I want to drown the way I feel. If I do, does it make the heat less real? Sit up on me, pull my waist, watch the blood rush.
My next guest is a singer-songwriter from Whitby, Ontario, whose debut album, Second Spring, received the Best Country Award at the 2008 Toronto Independent Music Awards. She has toured and performed with Ramblin' Jack Elliott, Melissa McLennan, Luke Doucette, Justin Rutledge, Jack Marks, and Protest the Hero. Her new album, which is her fourth full-length, is Love and Lust, and she is Jada Kelly, and I spoke to her back in June. Love and Lust is the new album. I had a chance to listen to some of the songs. I really enjoy it. How did this sort of idea for the album, like where did it start for you?
This album, it's about 2 years in the making, and it came from a place of heartbreak. This is some of my favorite albums are breakup records, but it's I think the most vulnerable I've ever been on a record, and it's the most honest I've been, and I was able to co-write it with a lot of Toronto songwriters like Peter Katz and Robin DeLunto and Tom Juhas and Jeremy Fisher. So we're all quite excited to finally be able to share it with the world.
Why do you think, heartbreak and breakup records, why do they make for such good music?
I've been asked that question a lot this week in different interviews, and I think it's the most vulnerable, time, and it's when I think, relationships can teach you so much about yourself, but especially as a songwriter, it can teach you about your writing process, and I found that during this time, I was just completely open, and I was allowing the emotions to completely take over, and some of my favorite songs that exist in the world were written from that headspace. And I think it's really all about vulnerability.
You stated that it's the hardest album you'll ever write, but also the most prolific time of your life. Do you think that emotion can fuel creativity?
Oh, 100%. It's kind of, it's how I process everything that I go through. I've been touring and writing for a long time now, and the more artists I meet and the more songwriters I meet in Nashville, where I've been living, that's where we all write from. So it definitely fuels everything I do.
Do you, just because of where the album came from, is that going to make its success, and the fact that you can, everything that it comes with, will that make it much more, like, will that make the success sweeter? Will it be a much more personal success, do you think?
I think no matter what the subject matter of the record was, I'm always really grateful for what happens with my music, and the more ears it gets into, the better. But this, this particular subject matter just happened to be the muse for this round. It was so healing to write it that anytime I do experience success through it, and just hearing everyone's response to it lately, it makes it just that much sweeter, because I was able to take something very dark and turn it into something really beautiful.
You've talked about the uncomfortable truths. How hard was it for you to sort of, face those ideas that you're talking about when you were writing this?
Well, I think it was also, this album isn't just about an affair or about infidelity it's also about forgiveness, and it's a coming of age album for me. I realized a lot of things about life and about myself as a woman in the music industry, and I realized a lot of things about just human frailty. So it was definitely hard to write, but it really, I'm not the same person anymore. I've really grown into a different artist, and I'm almost 30 now. I've been doing this for a long time, and there's a new maturity, and the people that worked on this record with me, it was just as much their experiences too. It was a group effort.
How would you describe your writing process as a whole, would you say?
I find that, I write every day, but I work, and when it comes down to finishing an actual song, I work best in a co-writing scenario. where you're kind of being held accountable for the song's completion and through another person. But for me, I'm always listening all day long. I have a little antenna on my head. You know, I'm always recording melodies into my phone or scribbling lyrics down on a piece of paper. I'm listening all the time. And when it comes time to record, I really just filter through all those notes and all those audio samples to find the songs that are most heartfelt and cohesive.
Speaking of heartfelt songs, I had a chance to listen to a few. I'm really struck by a couple. Make It Easy. I really like the musicality of it. What can you tell us about that track?
Well, Make It Easy was actually the last song we wrote on the album. We had started with about 65 demo songs, and Make It Easy was written so quickly in my living room on just an afternoon. And I wanted to write a song about desire, about being ashamed of your desire, whether, you know, from the point of view of a mistress who's fallen in love and can't control her desire and has fallen in love with someone that can't be with her, but it's also from the perspective of falling in love with your friend, of unexpectedly falling in love with someone that you've known for years and feeling ashamed of it. So that's really where that song came from. And the lyric video we have for that, the lyrics are actually written on my naked body in a bed. So it's very, I wanted to grasp that emotion, and out of all the songs, that's my favorite too.
And the other one I really enjoy, just because I think it's something different compared to some of the other stuff, is the very last track, Beauty. Where did that track come from?
Well, actually, I co-wrote that song with Peter Katz. He's a Canadian songwriter, and he's so amazing. And out of all the songs, that's definitely a lot more stripped down and more of a ballad. But we wanted to write a song that spoke about, you know, despite the hardships of life and, you know, everything that we go through, you know, here on Earth being human all the time, it's hard. It's hard to be human. And we wanted to write a song that said, despite these things, there is beauty, and the air that we are breathing is beautiful, and that being here is beautiful, and that you can see beauty no matter how dark it is. So yeah, we're both quite proud of that song, and I'm excited for people to hear it.
Now, you know, in spite of all you know, your music's folk sensibilities, people might be surprised to learn that you have worked with the great band Protest the Hero. How did that collaboration come about?
Well, actually, I grew up with Protest the Hero in Whitby, Ontario. I think I met them when I was about 15 or 16. They performed at our high school. And you know, I had been writing songs and performing at my talent shows. I was always quite shy in high school, but I ended up just sending them some of my songs, and that's how we became friends, and we've been friends ever since. It's about 10 years since that first record came out called Kazaya that I sang on. And people sometimes have trouble believing that I sing with a metal band, and I sometimes do as well, but it's definitely a very fond memory, that album and all the albums I do with them.
You mentioned earlier that you enjoy, you know, that you write best when you have other people. Why is collaboration important, and how does it help you from a creative perspective?
Well, it just kind of puts a bit of a fire under my ass. You know, I'm pretty good at procrastinating, but having another person just helps you voice the ideas that you're working through and the story that you're trying to create in a song. And two heads are better than one. So, you know, there's certain people I write with best, and there's certain people that I can't write with. It's really like a first date, you know, when you write with someone that you've never met.
Well, the album is Love and Lust. It comes out on June 3rd. Jada Kelly, thanks so much for your time today.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Have a good one. Cheers.
Bye.
That was Jada Kelly. And now here's her song, Mercy.
I'm not a child, but I believe.
That was Mercy by Jada Kelly. My final guest has won the Grand Poetry Slam Championships at both Vancouver Bedrock Poetry Slam as well as the Vancouver Poetry Slam. She has developed and executed programs in partnership with Toronto Poetry Project, Wordplay, Brendan McLeod's Traveling Slam, and the Culture Mentorship. She is the founder of Toronto's acclaimed Peace Pipe Poetry Sessions on Bloor, the former artistic director of the East Van Cultural Awards, as well as past and present volunteer coordinator for Hullabaloo Youth Spoken Word Festival. She is the former secretary and current member at large for Spoken Word Canada. As her most recent personal artistic endeavor, she tours the West Coast experimenting with music poetry fusion, collaborating with the likes of The Recipe, C.R. Avery, and powerhouse vocalist Chelsea D.E. Johnson. She is also the executive director of the Versus Poetry Festival. She is Jillian Christmas, and I spoke with her earlier this summer. So, you are head of the Versus Festival here in Vancouver, a great, great writing festival. How did you first get involved with such an event?
Well, I actually was involved with Versus before it was Versus, when it was Vancouver International Poetry Festival. I competed as one of the SIPs, the Canadian Individual Poetry Slam Championship competitors. That was my first year here in Vancouver. Actually, it was my first month or so in Vancouver. And I got involved in the community very shortly after that and got on board as the volunteer coordinator for the festival, I think a year later. And then it's, I guess, the rest is history. I was asked to help organize and became the artistic director the next year.
Poetry, and specifically spoken word poetry, is a art form that we've seen gain some mainstream momentum in the last decade or so, especially here in Vancouver. What do you like about spoken word, and how do you think it can challenge us in ways perhaps other literary and artistic forms can't?
Well, one of my favorite things about spoken word is that there is a very low barrier to entry for a lot of people. You don't have to have a certificate from an educational institution. You don't necessarily have to be vetted in any particular way, especially when we're talking specifically about slam poetry. You can walk off the street, walk onto the stage, and have an audience waiting there to hear your work immediately. And that is amazing. I think it's true to the roots of a lot of spoken word scenes, a lot of poetry scenes. I think, poets traditionally have been the voice of the people, have been the voice of maybe opposition to government or power systems, all kinds of things like that. So it makes a lot of sense to me that this is kind of the latest incarnation of spoken word, and that it is so open to so many people, and that so many people have found a home within it.
And why do you think East Vancouver has become such a mecca for these types of artists?
Well, I mean, East Vancouver is wonderful. I'm so happy to call it home. It's full of sort of bohemian artist types like myself. I was drawn to it for those reasons. I think that it's also one of a few places in Vancouver where living is still somewhat accessible, where rent is still somewhat accessible, which is often a reason why you find artists walking to a certain place. But there's also a lot of history of culture here on Commercial Drive, in and around Commercial Drive. And I think that is definitely like a magnet for a lot of artists. It certainly drew me from across the country. I'm originally from Toronto and just north of Toronto in Markham. And this scene and knowing of it was one of the things that sort of propelled me into Vancouver. One of the things that also makes Vancouver's art scene here on Commercial Drive specifically so visible to the rest of the country and really the rest of the world is that for the longest time, and I can't say how many years now, but for quite a long time, Vancouver Poetry Slam has been one of the only slams in Canada that videotapes all of the poems that go up on stage, of course, with the consent of the performers. And so we have this incredible database from Vancouver Poetry Slam, as well as from Versus Festival now, of a lot of the artists who have performed. And that's something that you can witness whether you're in Vancouver or outside of Vancouver. I think it's really special, and I think it really does, shine a spotlight on what's happening here.
One of the events that I'm intrigued by is the teen angst poetry. Where did that idea spring up about reading poems you wrote as a teen?
Well, the event is actually it's an event that happens regularly in Vancouver, hosted by Sarah Bino. It's her baby, her brainchild. She's been doing it for years now, and it's kind of her branded event. And she's been kind enough to lend it to us for the festival for this year. It's quite a popular event, and that's kind of evidenced by how many offshoots of it have happened all across, really, like North America. People are doing it all over the place now. You hear it on podcasts and things like that. And I think that the sort of delightful thing about it is that it's a chance for us to sort of smile at ourselves or laugh at ourselves, our younger selves, and see, you know, the growth that we have made from our original writings, and also just, you know, to let loose and not take ourselves too seriously. So you will hear people reading things that they wrote, I think, between the ages of 10 and 19. And one of the main elements of the event is that poets have to read something that they are embarrassed by. It can't be something that they're proud of. It can't be something that's like, oh, that's so polished and lovely. It has to be something that is a little bit embarrassing and, you know, maybe makes them cringe a little bit when they read it. I've done it myself, and it's very fun and very freeing, and actually a little cathartic.
Is it good, do you think, for us as artists to go back and revisit writing that we wouldn't necessarily publish to get a better idea of who we are, perhaps?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for one, I think it's just important to know yourself as an artist, to see the arc of your writing, your performance. I mean, myself, I go back and look at old videos of myself and old poetry books, and sometimes it's really difficult. I've had like a really tough time, you know, listening to old recordings or watching old videos, but it's also very informative. It's definitely, you get an education on yourself and the way that other people perceive you, because you have enough perspective or distance from those performances or those pieces of writing. And also, I think as a writer, it's important to keep things around that may turn into a new inspiration in the future. Like, just because something is old doesn't mean that it's dead. And I think that whether it be for silly purposes like teen angst poetry, or whether it be for really more serious purposes of reworking something, re-editing something, creating something new out of it, those are both very valuable things to any writer.
And another great event is the Femme Seas, which is at Café de Soleil. And how much of Verses is about exposing female writers? Because they often don't get perhaps the same treatment as the male writers do.
Yeah, I mean, Verses is about highlighting and giving a stage to all kinds of incredibly talented people who are often marginalized in other ways or in other spaces. I have an opportunity, a unique opportunity, to make space for people that I admire and people who, yeah, like you said, aren't always honored in the way that they should be. So we take that opportunity at every chance that we get. And it's really an honor to host FMCs, because, like, you really have to check it out. It's going to be a phenomenal event. We have four powerhouse women who are just going to, I mean, well, we're going to be grooving all night long, and you won't be disappointed.
Sometimes when people hear the word femme or anything like FMCs, they think that the word feminist can be a bad thing. How can we, or how can Verses alter that perception, perhaps, of feminist and feminist literature and feminist art?
You know, I as a woman of color, I have a complicated relationship with a lot of traditional ideas of feminism, and I attempt to challenge those ideas. I attempt to you know, refocus or maybe reframe feminism in a way that I can fit myself into, in a way that I can see myself inside of. And I think that that is a challenge for all of us to do. I think that if you don't like the face of something, then you need to step inside of it and change it. And I think feminism has given a lot to a lot of the artists who perform in this festival, a lot of the people who observe or participate in this festival. And yeah, I mean, I think that there are a lot of people who might make judgments about what feminism is, and, you know, criticism and reflection is very important, but I also think that participation is very important. And if you see something that seems like maybe it's not working, or it doesn't include you or whatever, like, we are hoping to invite people in to redefine, to feel included in those spaces, and also to listen to the experiences of people who exist in those spaces and who maybe have something to teach us.
So on that note, how can art and writing and poetry, how can it redefine and change the way we look at the world, change our perspective?
Oh, I mean, in a million different ways. Actually, I think in infinite different ways. I have said before, you know, I grew up as a very quiet child who was dealing with a lot of emotional turmoil and a lot of depression and things that made me go sort of inside of myself, and things that made me very quiet to the world around me. It was through writing and through reading, experiencing other people's stories and seeing myself in other people's stories, that I was able to communicate with the world. I think that is absolutely fundamental, especially for youth who often are feeling different, are not sure yet of their identities, or maybe are sure of their identities, but don't have people who are willing to listen. So to create space for those stories to be heard, to create space where people can see representations of themselves and know that they are important and valued, I don't know if there is better work than that. I feel very lucky to be able to do that.
You have some of my favorite writers coming to town during the festival. We've got Ivan Coyote, Ian Ketico, Wade Compton, Amber Dawn, Richard Wagamese. This is quite a list.
It really is.
How did you go about compiling such great wordsmiths?
You know, I like to keep my ears open. I have a lot of people around me. I'm surrounded by phenomenal artists, and the list of phenomenal artists that I am around and that I get to work with, it just keeps on growing. So I take people's advice. I listen to things that they are interested in, especially things that align with sort of the ethical sort of policies of the festival. And, you know, we have such a wealth of artists just here in Vancouver. We're very, very lucky. So if anything, it's like an embarrassment of riches. We just kind of make our wish list every year. We shoot for the stars, and we have been so lucky that we've been able to get so many of the artists who we've asked for. So hopefully that continues on into the future. But yeah, we get a lot of wonderful advice, and then of course we follow our hearts and our ears a little bit too.
Well, it's the Versus Festival of Words 2016, running from April 21st to May the 1st. Jillian Christmas, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Alrighty, have a good one. Ciao.
You too. Take care.
That was poet Jillian Christmas. We're going to take you out with one final song by Jada Kelly off her album Love and Lust. This is Can't Outrun. Thanks for tuning in. Episode 4, which comes out on Monday, will feature author Jim Lynch, documentarian Jerry Rothwell, and metric bassist Josh Winstead. We'll talk about his solo album. That's it for me now. See you later. Ciao for now.